We began the series and noticed that the reason why Joseph is such a compelling figure for us in the Bible is really because of the many powerful ways that he prefigures Christ. And as Brian mentioned, there are more and more ways than you might even realize at first, the more that you look at his story. The more you look, the more you see. And that's really what makes Bible study so beautiful and so exciting, at least for me, is that the more I study, the more I see. And it seems like you can just peel the layers deeper and deeper, and study is rewarding in that way. And so as we continue with Joseph's story here, we'll continue to do the same thing. Tonight we will look at chapter 39 and try to just refamiliarize ourselves with the details of the story. We'll try to make practical applications for ourselves along the way, but we will ultimately try to refocus ourselves on what the greater story actually is, how Joseph prefigures Jesus, and how Jesus is the true and better Joseph in many ways. But when we left Joseph at the end of Genesis 37, he had been sold to Midianite or Ishmaelite traders, and they had taken him down to Egypt and sold him to a man named Potiphar there. And Joseph's story continues in Genesis 39. And so let's begin here in verses 1 through 6. It says, "Now Joseph had been brought down to Egypt, and Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the guard, an Egyptian, had brought him from the Ishmaelites," Potiphar bought him from the Ishmaelites who had brought him down there. The Lord was with Joseph, and he became a successful man, and he was in the house of his Egyptian master. His master saw that the Lord was with him, and that the Lord caused all that he did to succeed in his hands. So Joseph found favor in his sight and attended him, and he made him overseer of his house and put him in charge of all that he had. From the time that he had made him overseer in his house and over all that he had, the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake. The blessing of the Lord was on all that he had in house and field. So he left all that he had in Joseph's charge. And because of him, he had no concern about anything but the food he ate." Now, this text tells us that Potiphar was an officer of Pharaoh and the captain of the guard. He's introduced the same way in 39:1 as he was in 37:36, an officer of Pharaoh and the captain of the guard. And this is another one of those translational questions where we're not exactly sure what that means. In Hebrew, literally, it has something to do with execution. And so some people think that Potiphar was maybe the chief executioner. Other people have suggested that he was maybe the chief cook, you know, has a lot of executing animals to do in a job like that. But what's interesting is that this exact title is given to the general who destroys Jerusalem in 2 Kings 25. In 2 Kings 25, Nebuchadnezzar sends the captain of the guard, Nebuzaradan, to go and destroy the temple in Jerusalem. And so what that means is that Potiphar was probably a very high-ranking official, just like Nebuzaradan was for Babylon. It could mean that Potiphar was actually in command of all of Pharaoh's armed forces. And so rather than being the chief cook or the chief of security or something like that, it may actually be that Potiphar is the commander-in-chief in Egypt at this time. And so he is a high-ranking official in the most powerful empire in the world. And Joseph serves in his house. So just let that help you understand what life would be like for Joseph. To be at the beck and call of one of the highest officials in the most powerful empire in the world. And I imagine that after Potiphar had bought Joseph as a slave, that he probably started with some smaller kinds of jobs first. Maybe he started out with housekeeping or groundskeeping or something like that, but it wasn't long before he would have started to run the housekeeping crew or the groundskeeping crew. Everything that Joseph did, he did well, and the Lord blessed him. And we see that emphasized in this text, that it was the Lord who was blessing Joseph in all of this. In verse 2, it says, the Lord was with Joseph, and he became a successful man, and he was in the house of his Egyptian master. In verse 5, it says, from the time that he made him overseer of his house and over all that he had, the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake. The blessing of the Lord was on all that he had in house and field. And I would suggest that there's probably more than one way in which that is true. You know, it wasn't too long ago that we talked about the race that is set before us as employees, as workers, and how the Lord expects us to work for him and not for man. I believe Joseph would have had that kind of mentality. He would have been honest, he would have been reliable, he would have been a hard worker, and those kinds of things generally work towards success in business and employment. But clearly the Lord has plans for Joseph, and the Lord is with him in Potiphar's house, and so everything that he does seems to prosper. Everything that he does was managed successfully. And so Potiphar gives him more and more responsibility until it says here in verse 6, he left all that he had in Joseph's charge. And because of him, he had no concern about anything but the food he ate. And so Potiphar, with all of his vast resources, all of his vast responsibilities, he's entrusted so much of it to Joseph that really all he has to do is sit down at his table and have food brought to him. Now, Potiphar noticed why Joseph was successful. Verse 3 mentions his master saw that the Lord was with him and that the Lord caused all that he did to succeed in his hands. Again, I'm not exactly sure what all of that means. I don't know if maybe Potiphar knew anything about Yahweh, the God of the Hebrews, at all. I wonder if Joseph had told him about his God. Maybe in all of his work, he had opportunity to speak to Potiphar and to tell him about the promises that God had made to his father and to his grandfather. Maybe Joseph was somebody who had the opportunity to tell Potiphar about why he worked the way that he worked. Had the opportunity to say, I am honest and faithful in all of my work because I'm trying to serve the Lord and glorify him. But maybe it was his honesty, his faithfulness, his sincerity, or his words, but in any case, Joseph became an ambassador for the Lord in Egypt. And I think that's a powerful example for us. That though he had been sold as a slave to Egypt, he remembered who he was, he remembered his God, and Potiphar was able to see that influence in his life and in his work. And so for now, everything seems to be going very well. But the story continues in verse 6. It says, now Joseph was handsome in form and appearance. And after a time, his master's wife cast her eyes on Joseph and said, lie with me. But he refused and said to his master's wife, behold, because of me, my master has no concern about anything in the house, and he has put everything that he has in my charge. He is not greater in this house than I am, nor has he kept back anything from me except you, because you are his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? And as she spoke to Joseph day after day, he would not listen to her, to lie beside her, or to be with her. Now, keep in mind that Joseph was 17 years old when he was introduced to us in Genesis 37. Most people think that a few years have gone by at this point, and so he's probably in his early 20s. And as he's working in Potiphar's house, his form and appearance catch the eye of Potiphar's wife. And after a time, it says she decides to act on her desires. I wonder how long Potiphar's wife had been watching Joseph. I wonder where her gaze fell as she watched him work. I wonder what kinds of thoughts entered her mind and how long she let those thoughts develop. The story reminds us of other stories in the Bible. It reminds me a little bit of David, who on his rooftop saw Bathsheba bathing. And David apparently continued to linger as he watched. And he let his thoughts continue to grow and his desires continue to build until his desire conceived and gave birth to sin. And Potiphar's wife has the same experience here. That as she has been watching Joseph and as she's been desiring him, her desires have conceived and produced sin. And then in the English translation here, she says to Joseph, "Lie with me." And in Hebrew, that's actually even more forceful than it seems in English. In the English translation, that's three words. In Hebrew, it's two words. And both of them are imperative statements. And so this is a command coming to Joseph from a very powerful woman, insisting that he lie with her. Now, I think that this would have been a very difficult temptation for Joseph for multiple reasons. For one, Joseph is a young man in his early 20s, and Potiphar's wife is likely very attractive. She's married to somebody who is rich and powerful, and rich and powerful people tend to have physically attractive wives. One of the perks of the position, I suppose. That would have made the temptation difficult. But also think about the power imbalance that's at play. You ever been in a position where you've had to tell your boss no because he's asked you to do something that's wrong? It's a hard thing to do when you feel that pressure from somebody who has power over you. It's hard to stand up and say, "What you're asking me to do is wrong." Especially when there might be consequences, especially when your career might be on the line. Joseph's career is on the line here, but his life is also on the line. To be a slave in a house like this would mean that he would have very little power if things go south. And so the easiest thing for him to do would be to simply follow commands, follow the orders he's been given. But notice Joseph's response again in verse 8. It says, "He refused and said to his master's wife, 'Behold, because of me, my master has no concern about anything in the house, and he has put everything that he has in my charge. He's not greater in this house than I am, nor has he kept back anything from me except you, because you are his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God?'" I see several good examples here for us. And the first thing is just that Joseph's refusal of Potiphar's wife's advance is very clear. He doesn't leave any room for interpretation. He doesn't leave any kind of, you know, daylight for her to see. He's very emphatic. He's very clear. He closes the door on this whole circumstance. He doesn't say something like, "Well, you know, if situations were different, I would." Or, "There's a part of me that would like to, but..." He doesn't couch his response like that in any way. Nothing good comes from saying things like that, you know? If you're in a position where you are tempted to do the wrong thing, whether it's sexual or otherwise, the best thing you can do is to resolutely say, "I will not do this." Not to leave any kind of impression that there might be a possibility. And so Joseph doesn't flirt with her. He doesn't leave any impression that he considers this is a possibility for them. He very clearly says he will not do this. But the second thing that Joseph does well is he explains his moral position to Potiphar's wife. He explains to her, he says, "Your husband trusts me. You know, the reason why I'm in this position is because your husband believes I'm a man of good character. He believes that he can entrust responsibility to me, and I'm not going to take advantage of him. I'm not going to harm him. I'm not going to take something that doesn't belong to me." And in verse 9, he says, he has not kept back anything from me except you, because you are his wife. Another Bible story of temptation that this reminds me of is Eve's temptation in the garden. You remember in Genesis chapter 3, when the serpent came to the woman. In verse 1, he said, "Did God actually say, 'You shall not eat of any tree in the garden?'" And in verse 2, the woman said to the serpent, "We may eat of the fruit of the trees in the garden, but God said, 'You shall not eat of the fruit of the tree that is in the midst of the garden, neither shall you touch it, lest you die.'" Isn't it interesting that the one tree that was off limits in the garden is the tree that tempted Eve to sin? The one thing that God said is forbidden is the very thing that gripped her heart and held on tightly. And it's the thing that Satan capitalized on to persuade her to rebel against the will of God. I think there's something about human nature in this, where there's something about the forbidden fruit that's tempting. There's something about knowing that you're not supposed to do this that just sort of makes you feel like you want to. Paul describes his relationship with the law sort of like that in Romans chapter 7. He talks about how the law aroused desires in him, because when God says, "Don't do this one thing," there's a part of us that thinks, "That's sort of now the thing that I want to do." And so there was only one tree in the garden that was off limits, and it was that tree that tempted Eve to sin. There was only one thing in all of Potiphar's house that was off limits, and that was Potiphar's wife. But where Eve failed, Joseph succeeded. Because a third thing that Joseph does very well is that he identifies sin for what it is. Notice again in verse 9, the question that he asks her is, "How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God?" I think that if we got in the habit of describing sin that way, we would probably be a lot more able to resist the temptation to commit it. You know, Joseph doesn't just call this an affair. He doesn't call it a fling. You know, he doesn't use some dressed up, frilly word. He says, "This is sin. This is great wickedness. How could I do this against God?" He has a very clear image of what this is, and he communicates it to the person who's involved in the temptation. I would suggest that you try that sometime. If you feel tempted, ask yourself, "Do I want to do this wickedness and sin against God?" Maybe it's when you are speaking to somebody else. Maybe there's a situation in which they invite you to do something that's wrong. How do you respond? Well, in that situation, you actually have an opportunity to let them see how important the will of God is to you. Maybe they'll think that you're weird. Maybe they'll turn around and walk away. And if they do that, then that might actually be your way of escape, because the temptation just walks away with them. But to ask them, "Do you want me to sin against God? Do you want me to commit this great wickedness?" Even if you're alone, you might ask yourself questions like that before you click on the link on your computer, before you continue down some train of thought that's happening in your mind, before you lash out in revenge or anger. Think about, "Do I really want to commit wickedness and sin against God?" I would suggest that this is actually the definition of godliness. Godliness is really all about perspective. Sometimes we think that godliness means godlikeness. When we talk about somebody being a godly person, sometimes we think that that means that their character is sort of like God's. And that's a noble goal. And in fact, that's something that we ought to be pursuing, that through the Spirit we're being made to be like God. But that's not actually the definition of godliness. Godliness is actually having an awareness of God's presence that influences your actions. Godliness is a conscious choice to honor God. It's living with an awareness that God is here, God sees, God is present in this moment. A godly person is somebody who thinks about God. He thinks about God when he's tempted. He thinks about God when he's at work. He thinks about God when he's with his family. That's what a godly person is. And Joseph is a godly person. And so Joseph refuses in this situation. But as we'll see, Potiphar's wife is relentless. In verse 10, it says that she spoke to Joseph day after day. He would not listen to her, but she continued to pursue him. In verse 11, the story continues, and it says, "But one day when he went into the house to do his work, and none of the men of the house was there in the house, she caught him by his garment, saying, 'Lie with me.' But he left his garment in her hand and fled and got out of the house. And as soon as she saw that he had left his garment in her hand and had fled out of the house, she called to the men of her household and said to them, 'See, he has brought among us a Hebrew to laugh at us. He came in to me to lie with me, and I cried out with a loud voice. And as soon as he heard that I lifted up my voice and cried out, he left his garment beside me and fled and got out of the house.' Then she laid up his garment by her until his master came home. And she told him the same story, saying, 'The Hebrew servant whom you have brought among us came in to me to laugh at me. But as soon as I lifted up my voice and cried, he left his garment beside me and fled out of the house.'" I wonder if Potiphar's wife thinks that what's really holding Joseph back is the fear of getting caught. You know, it's easy to kind of feign righteousness when you think that other people might see. You know, it's easy to just sort of pretend to be noble-minded when there's that background fear that somebody might discover what you've done. But true character is what you do when nobody's watching. True character is what you do when you know that there's nobody that can see. That's how you really find out what you're made of. And so Potiphar's wife looks for a moment to test the true character of Joseph. She looks for a time when the possibility of getting caught can be eliminated, and she finds it. One day she has him in her house all by himself. And so this time she grabs his clothing and she repeats her forceful invitation. And this time, without hesitation, Joseph just takes off. He gets out of there so fast that he leaves his garment in the clutch of her hand. I wonder if Paul had this story in mind when he wrote things like "flee from sexual immorality" in 1 Corinthians 6:18. Or as Brian read for us earlier from 2 Timothy chapter 2, where Paul says to Timothy, "Flee youthful passions." A lot of times that's a metaphorical thing, you know? Like, you just sort of stay away from them, you don't try to get too close to them, you recognize tempting situations and you avoid them, but sometimes it literally means just going for the door. And Joseph does that. He knows that this isn't a good situation for him to be in, and so he takes the way of escape that God has given him. And rather than letting this situation develop any further, Joseph decides to leave his cloak in the clutches of Potiphar's wife. But she has a plan. And now, for the second time in Joseph's story, his torn garment is used as evidence for false witnesses. Isn't that interesting? Earlier, his coat of many colors was presented as made-up evidence for his murder by, or his death by, wild animal. Now, his torn garment is presented as made-up evidence for his sexual assault. But Potiphar's wife uses this physical evidence along with a blend of racism and sensationalism to change the narrative. She accuses the foreigner of violent crime and blames all of their problems on him. I suppose some things never change. But she says, it's this Hebrew. He's the one. Look at this terrible, violent, sexual crime that he's committed against me. And all of the evidence is stacked against him. I mean, think about this from the perspective of those who would have heard the story. Potiphar's wife has physical evidence. She has the attacker's garment in her hand. There were witnesses who came when they heard her scream. By all accounts, this would be an open and shut case. Who would you believe? The wife of a highly respected public dignitary or some random young male from a different country? And so Joseph finds himself in a very difficult situation. Verse 19 says, as soon as his master heard the words that his wife spoke to him, "This is the way your servant treated me," his anger was kindled. And Joseph's master took him and put him into the prison, the place where the king's prisoners were confined, and he was there in prison. But the Lord was with Joseph and showed him steadfast love and gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. And the keeper of the prison put Joseph in charge of all the prisoners who were in the prison. Whatever was done there, he was the one who did it. The keeper of the prison paid no attention to anything that was in Joseph's charge because the Lord was with him. And whatever he did, the Lord made it succeed. Now, this whole situation puts Potiphar in a very awkward position. He is a public figure. He is well known. He has high esteem and influence to be mindful of. He can't just ignore his wife's claims. But I have to think that somewhere deep down, he has his doubts. Verse 19 says that his anger was kindled. But you might notice that it doesn't say at whom it is kindled. I wonder if he knew his wife well enough to know that this story might not be everything she makes it out to be. Maybe he was angry at Joseph, but if he was, his anger certainly seems to be a little bit muted. Because in a situation like this, you would surely expect that a servant who assaults your wife would be put to death. But instead of putting Joseph to death, he sends him to prison. Remember verse 3 of this chapter. It said, his master saw that the Lord was with him and that the Lord caused all that he did to succeed in his hands. Sometimes when you have proven yourself to people as being trustworthy, reliable, sincere, when there's a situation in which you don't look so good, you might get the benefit of the doubt. I think that's what's going on with Joseph. Maybe Potiphar knows that he can't just ignore this situation, but he can't in good conscience put a man like this to death. And so he sends him to prison. Now, this was certainly merciful by Potiphar, but it still must have felt pretty crushing to Joseph. Think about yourself in Joseph's shoes. Here he was, a Hebrew slave who had risen up to a high position by working hard and serving the Lord. He had come from nothing. He's already lost everything in his life, and yet by being a faithful, hard, diligent worker and doing everything right, he's risen to a position of power. He's resisted the temptations to sin. He's done everything possibly that he could do. And he's done it the right way. And just like that, it seems like his life is over. Thrown in prison to rot, facing a sentence of life without parole. And you know, sometimes that's how life goes. Sometimes you do everything right and it just doesn't work out. Sometimes you work hard. Sometimes you make smart financial decisions. You make good relationship decisions. You work hard. You're honest. You resist temptation. You do your best to serve the Lord. And then it feels like the rug just gets ripped out from underneath you. And that's Joseph. But notice verse 21 again. It says, "But the Lord was with Joseph and showed him steadfast love and gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison." Though it might not have looked like it at first, the Lord was with Joseph in prison. And I think that's a powerful point. Because just when it seems like the Lord has abandoned you, just when it seems like God has forsaken you, just when it seems like God has turned his back on you, we can know that he never will. The Lord will be with us in the prisons that we go into. The Lord will be with us in the terrible health issues that we have. The Lord will be with us as we navigate economic uncertainty, career issues, health issues, family issues. The Lord is with us in all of those times. And that's actually how we can resist the temptation to despair in difficult circumstances. Because we can know that it's never hopeless. That we may feel alone, but we can know that we never are. Now, there might also be more going on than you realize. Because Joseph doesn't know it yet, but he is exactly where he needs to be. And this morning we talked a little bit about all of these seeming coincidences that put Joseph in the exact right place at the exact right time. And Joseph actually needs to be in this prison. Because as we'll see in subsequent lessons, it's in the prison where he has the opportunity to interpret Pharaoh's dreams. And so though he can't understand the bigger picture at this point, God sees it all. And I think that's encouraging too. You might not realize the good that God is doing with you when you go through dark times. But we can trust God and know that his perspective is much greater than ours. And so God will take Joseph's desperate situation and turn it into the exact perfect opportunity. And Joseph's experience in prison actually mirrors his experience in Potiphar's house. Did you notice that? In Potiphar's house, he is gradually put in charge of the whole place until he's basically running it. And then he starts from the bottom again in prison, and the same thing happens again. The officer of the prison, the keeper of the prison, put Joseph in charge of all the prisoners and everything that happened there. And so, that concludes chapter 39. Now, in this chapter, I think we also see several glimpses of Christ. I would suggest that in this chapter, Joseph faced three distinct temptations. The first was to be intimidated by power. He had to stand up to Potiphar's wife when she tried to use her power to convince him to do what was wrong. The second was he had to resist the temptation to be allured by lust. Surely that was a temptation for him to act on his physical impulses and desires. And the third temptation was probably the greatest of all, which was to despair in prison, to give up on God, to say, "Look, I've done everything right, and this is what you give me, I quit." Three different temptations. And Joseph resisted them all. You can think of a time when Jesus resisted three temptations too, can't you? In the wilderness, the devil came to him, presented three distinct temptations to him, and Jesus responded a lot like Joseph did. He refused clearly the devil's advances. He didn't leave any kind of opportunity for the devil. He didn't say, "Well, if circumstances were different, maybe I would." He clearly said no to Satan's temptations. He used the word of God to explain his moral position. Jesus didn't just say, well, you know, I'm not supposed to do that. Jesus said, this is what the word of God says. It is written. And then he explained why he had resolved in his heart not to do what Satan told him to do. And then thirdly, Jesus identified sin for what it is. He clearly put his trust in the will of God. Matthew chapter 4 in verse 10, at the end of those three temptations, Jesus says to Satan, "Be gone, for it is written, you shall worship the Lord your God, and him only shall you serve." Secondly, Joseph was innocent, but as we've seen, he was convicted of charges by false witnesses. That's what happened to Jesus too, isn't it? If you would turn to Mark chapter 14 and see if this doesn't make you think about the accusations brought by Potiphar's wife. Mark 14 in verse 55. It says, "Now the chief priest and the whole council were seeking testimony against Jesus to put him to death, but they found none. For many bore false witness against him, but their testimony did not agree. And some stood up and bore false witness against him, saying, 'We heard him say, I will destroy this temple that is made with hands, and in 3 days I will build another not made with hands.' Yet even about this, their testimony did not agree. And the high priest stood up in the midst and asked Jesus, 'Have you no answer to make? What is it that these men testify against you?' But he remained silent and made no answer. Again, the high priest asked him, 'Are you the Christ, the Son of the Blessed?' And Jesus said, 'I am. And you will see the Son of Man seated at the right hand of power and coming with the clouds of heaven.' And the high priest tore his garments and said, 'What further witnesses do we need? You have heard his blasphemy. What is your decision?' And they all condemned him as deserving death." Just like Joseph, Jesus was convicted of made-up charges by false witnesses. There was spite, there was envy at play, there was hearsay, there was circumstantial evidence. But because of the hate of their hearts, they condemned Jesus to death. But after that, you remember where Jesus was taken next, right? Jesus was taken to a high-ranking government official who represented the most powerful empire in the world. Joseph was taken to Potiphar, who was the captain of the guard for Pharaoh in Egypt. But Jesus was taken to Pilate, who was the governor of Judea for Caesar in Rome. Just like Egypt was the most powerful empire in the world in Joseph's day, Rome was the global power in Jesus's. And I suggested earlier that Potiphar may have been a bit conflicted about what to do with Joseph. And while there is a little bit of supposition in that in Genesis, it's clear that Pilate was conflicted about Jesus. He was conflicted because he knew that Jesus was innocent. He knew that Jesus had done nothing deserving death. But he also knew that the people were crying out for his punishment. And rather than conducting a full investigation and coming to some just verdict about what to do, Mark chapter 15 and verse 15 says, "So Pilate, wishing to satisfy the crowd, released for them Barabbas. And having scourged Jesus, he delivered him to be crucified." I wonder if Potiphar had a similar motivation for punishing Joseph. But clearly, Jesus was punished by somebody who doubted his guilt in order to satisfy other people. In all these ways, we continue to see that Jesus is the true and better Joseph. And just like God used Joseph's imprisonment to bring about the fulfillment of his plan to bless his people, God used the cross of Christ to do the same. Just when it seems like all hope is lost, God often does his most powerful work. And out of the darkness of the cross, God has brought forth the light of salvation. And in his sovereign plan, in his time and in his way, he is glorified. There might be somebody that is moved by the story of Joseph to think more about the story of Jesus. I hope that as we go through this series, that it builds our faith and helps us to see that these texts that we read do not come to us merely by human or cultural means. The only explanation for the way all of these themes fit together so perfectly is that we have received revelation from a divine editor who's put the story together. And as we ought to be impressed with the righteousness of a person like Joseph, it ought to make us even more impressed with the perfect righteousness of Jesus the Christ. If you believe that all of these stories point to him because he is the Son of God, that he died for your sins, that he went down into the pit and rose again so that you could be blessed, if you're willing to repent of your sins, to give your life to him, to confess that belief openly, and to be dedicated to living for his purposes and his glory, then you can be united with him in baptism